I give this summary slightly nervously because I feel a little bit like an undergraduate at the beginning of the stage. I want you all to tell me what I should read. I started off by saying this paper will build on my chapter, which was in this book, which it will. But I have to be honest, which is the chapter in the book is actually a paper I wrote to a very learned journal, which rejected it. And I sent about 10 years ago an outline of, or no, I sent a well-polished, brilliant paper to a leading legal journal, and I got two anonymous reviewers' comments back, which I think we all suffer this. I thought they were both so irritating. I put the thing away for 5 years before I could even read it. One of them might have been you, Andrew. one doesn't know about that. And one of them said at great length that there was a huge American literature on this and that I should read it, but didn't tell me what the huge American literature was. And I actually find it very difficult to get excited by American literature. So again, you can tell me that I ought to get excited by American literature. But I would be genuinely, genuinely interested if you wanted to say, Nikki, dear, you've forgotten some of these very important things and treated me in a rather nicely patronising way as though I was a stupid undergraduate who hadn't done my homework. So that's where I start. And what I'm also saying in that start is to say that I've thought for years and years that we've got sentencing quite wrong. Sentencing isn't that one-off moment when judges sentence people. And if we don't recognise that, all sorts of problems follow on from that. So I've started off here with some starting points about what is sentencing. And that first paragraph turns into something a bit more complicated, like to what extent should judicial decision making trump political administrative policy making. In recent years, I've moved from thinking that I'm an active researcher on anything to do with sentencing much more to looking being an active sentencer on parole and recall. I hope I stay up to date with sentencing law as much as any human possibly can in this world. But the reality to me is, for example, yesterday I was in Warren Hill Prison talking to lifers about their sentence. One man who'd just been told that day that he was being released on June the X and how terrified he is about coming out after 15 years. And this talking to prisoners reminds me that I am much, much more interested in how law works than all this pretense of what it is in books and how the pretense of how it is in books. We need to, I think, be challenging how it works in practice. So that's a little bit about where I start. Breadth of the criminal sanction, I guess we've all worried about for quite a long time. I hate this word disposal. If the one thing I'm wanting to do in sentencing is bring in the humanity, the reality of people's lives, you aren't disposing of them when you're sentencing of them. And yet in this crazy document, we haven't got any. Have we got anyone from the Law Commission here? I feel much more comfortable being cheekily rude about it if they were here. I wish, they're here, there we are. I'm speaking to you, David, Ormerod, and Lyndon, and so on in the tape recorder. I think they're doing a fantastic job trying to codify criminal law, but sentencing law, but I'm not sure that it's worth the effort if this is what we're going to end up with. It's well worth the effort if politicians then realise this is nonsense and we have to have something much simpler. So it is really interesting seeing that a draft sentencing code, now the criminal code wasn't nearly as problematic as a sentencing code, and it shouldn't be like that. What is a sentence? On the left-hand side, we have what they think a sentence is, and then look at their terminology. I think it's really interesting. Primary sentencing orders and further orders relating to sentencing. They're not talking about ancillary orders, which I'm really glad they've got rid of ancillary orders, because the ancillary orders hurt very much as the substantive orders. But there are a load of other things which ought to be in the right-hand column, which they haven't bothered to put in. Forfeiture in 16 different Acts of Parliament at the moment. Sentencing law is hugely, hugely, hugely too complicated. The courts get it wrong all the time. I always teach students the case of Mrs. Noon, as lots of you may know, who the Master of the Rolls in the Court of Appeal was incredibly... I have to be careful of this tape recorded, don't I? I was going to say... no, I won't say what I was going to say. Held forth about the ridiculous complexity of the law, which has taken a whole day in the Court of Appeal, and we, after all this effort, we come to the right answer. And then the Supreme Court says they came to the wrong answer. And the whole thing is, she's a very short-term prisoner with consecutive sentences. It should not defeat the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court when her release date is. So that's sort of obvious that there's too much and it's too complicated. And we go on to the next page and there are other comments there. Why do we have so much? What is a sanction or what isn't? Citing Andrew there in terms of what may appear to be compromise with normal standards of procedural fairness. Well, I'm teasing him because he's sitting next to me and saying, you can't compromise with normal standards of procedural fairness, can you? Come on. So we'll see how he responds to that. Sentences, therefore, far too broad, and I think I skipped over another of the things that I wanted to say in relation to EU criminal law. I've never got it, EU criminal law. I try to pretend that I'm an expert on EU criminal law and will talk about it with people. But what is a criminal sanction and what is an administrative sanction? You can't just say the label that you attach to it makes the definition of what it is. There have got to be consequences which flow from the fact that it's a criminal sanction. And I'm hoping that lots of you will tell me there is a good literature which is convincing, but I'm not sure that there is a good literature which is convincing on those issues. So that's breadth. Then I'm also talking about depth, if you like, or length of criminal sanction. And there again, I think there are huge problems which nobody adequately engages with about, probably most people in this room will agree with me, I don't know, that sentence isn't something which just happens in the Crown Court or the Magistrates Court when somebody sentences. But I do think we would disagree in this room when a sentence ends. And there are huge problems. Clearly, you come out at different times. One of the things which is deeply shocking in recent years has been Parliament's every year change in the release rules on extended sentences, so that sometimes they come out at half term, sometimes between two thirds and three quarters, and all sorts of issues around that that we should worry about. The indirect consequences which go on for a very, very long time. The man I talked to yesterday who is really frightened of recall, and he's right to be recalled. More than half the IPPs released every year are recalled to prison, and that's a really shocking figure. In one year, more lifers were recalled to prison than were released. Recall is a real, real issue. It's getting bigger all the time. The ORA, the Offender Rehabilitation Act supervisions, that's an area, I don't know whether you all worry about that as I do. The government decided in its wisdom 2 or 3 years ago that there was a problem with short-term offenders, the reconviction rate being higher than for long-term offenders, so we'd better do something about that. So everyone should get supervised on release for 12 months post-sentence. Well, it's not post-sentence if they're being supervised, if there are sanctions. It is part of the sentence. And it's just nonsense to try and pretend that it's not facing, it's not part of the system. MAPA, hugely under-noticed by criminal lawyers. I guess one of the things I'm trying to say in this paper is another thing which I have sort of bleated about but not written seriously enough about in the last 20 years or so, is the line between the things that criminologists get interested in and the things that lawyers get interested in, because they don't overlap enough. More criminologists will know what MAPA is than lawyers do. Well, that's deeply shocking, because multi-agency public protection arrangements are scandalous, depending on how you want to define scandal. Either there are loads of dodgy, violent and sexual offenders out there who aren't being adequately supervised, or far too many are being supervised, and I don't know which way it is because nobody's really studying it and criminal lawyers are busily ignoring it. So I think we should worry about that. Then I go on in this jumble stream of consciousness to talk about judicial scrutiny of sentencing. And there I think I increasingly get excited about that by looking at France and not America. Thank you, that anonymous reviewer of my paper, which still stings 10 years on. France is really interesting, the juge d'application des peines. And they're interesting because the juges are very different creatures. They're young women, they are career judges. But if you go to a parole board hearing in a French prison, the governing governor comes and meets them at the gate and bows and takes them seriously. Most of the governing governors in our system wouldn't even know the parole board had come visiting, let alone think it was his or her duty to come and be nice to them. And there are some very fundamental questions, I think, about the extent to which judges should be involved in the judicial supervision of sentences. Partly because I'm a bleeding heart liberal, or however I self-define, I think if we get judges more involved in the implementation of sentencing, they might be less punitive when they impose their sentences. I have been really interested in recent years to discover some senior judges who have visited their prisoners, and one in particular I almost might name into the tape recorder, but I don't think I will. But he's written an article in Benchmark, the Judges Journal, and he's a very famous leading top judge, as the Daily Mail might say, but he really is. And he's, when I sent him an email to say, I hope you don't mind me sending you this email, but I've just met the prisoner who you visited at his request, and I just want to tell you, I think you've changed his life. And he emailed straight back, I didn't know him, and said, I think he changed my life too. And it's been really interesting. I've discovered another judge, a senior judge, who probably wouldn't want to be named, who's been to visit his one of his prisoners. I know another judge who's exchanged Christmas cards with his prisoner. They don't shout about that, and I think it's a really important thing. I think it's really interesting that some judges are doing that because they're human beings, but they're not talking about it a lot. And it's an issue which I would like to explore more. I think drug rehabilitation hearings are really good because judges and magistrates learn how incredibly difficult it is to keep off drugs when you're surrounded by your drug addict friends or whatever. But I think it's good for judges. That's probably not a good reason for doing it. I think it might keep down sentencing levels. Is that a good reason to do it? The parole board, which is my, I suppose, my main interest, it's a bit mean to quote Andrew again here and take a sentence completely out of context in his...
That's because you think I was one of the anonymous reviewers.
The parole board is a judicial authority, although not a court, so that's my challenge to the young man on my left. Can you explain that statement, please, in your response? What is a judicial authority that's not a court? What is a court or tribunal? I would say that the parole board certainly isn't. The Minister of Justice proved last month he doesn't think it is because he thinks he can sack the chairman of the parole board, which is an outrage. You don't sack the Lord Chief Justice because one High Court judge has got overturned on appeal. It completely misunderstands, I think, the understanding of what the parole board is, and I know the tape recorder's on. There are big, big issues about why the parole board ought to be an independent court or tribunal, but we're not treating it as such at the moment. It's still on the second floor of the Ministry of Justice. Its website to save money is now part of the Ministry of Justice's website. It's getting less independent rather than more independent. And why do I think it should be an independent court or tribunal? Should judges take into account release rules when sentencing? It's been an issue I've been a bit grumpy on for a number of years. I rather hope that Lyndon would be here so I could tease Lyndon. the Court of Appeal very recently in the amazing decision of Thompson, Cummings, Fitzgerald and Ford, says the decision of the Court of Appeal in Bradbury was wrong and shouldn't be followed. In relation to this analysis, we acknowledge the assistance we've received from the commentary by Lyndon Harris. I thought I was the grumpiest person in publication and they should cite me. But I'll talk to Lyndon about that later. Should judges take into account release rules when they fix their sentence? This in recent case of Thompson, have you seen Thompson yet? It's really bizarre because it's about Section 11(3) of the Criminal Appeal Act, which requires the Court of Appeal on an appeal against sentence to exercise its powers such that, taking the case as a whole, the appellant is not more severely dealt with on appeal than he was dealt with by the court below. When we rearrange sentences and we decide to give an extended sentence or not to give an extended sentence, then the question is, they've got to be very careful to look at release rules to decide whether they're giving something more complicated. I'm delighted by this decision because I think sentencing judges should also think about release rules when they're thinking about, let's say, consecutive extended sentences. But the message that we're still getting very loud and clear from the Court of Appeal, from the Sentencing Council, from Coleman Tracy in cases like Francis and Lawrence is judges don't. You fix the right sentence, and the fact that Parliament keeps changing the early release rules is irrelevant. And it's another thing which I think we have to worry about quite a lot. This is quite a stream of consciousness, deliberately, as I said. My conclusions, the administration of sanctions is complex and lacks clarity. Does it matter? Yes, of course it does. We need to understand our sentencing law and have to have law that nobody understands is an outrage. I'm terrified by the consequence of war boys, which may make parole board panels more cautious, allows the Ministry of Justice to sack a very good chairman of the parole board, and Dominic Lawson say it's high time we got rid of parole boards altogether. Who does he think is going to decide when lifers should come out if you don't have a parole board? There are lots of issues which need thinking about. Trust in sentencing, the case that I've given there is the War Boys decision. Judicial reviews are always interesting, of course, when they decide that the decision maker was irrational, because irrational used to be so unreasonable that no reasonable person could make it. And when I'm teaching students, I say it means bonkers. And it is really interesting when the courts say that somebody's decision was bonkers. Whether or not that decision of that panel of the parole board was bonkers, I think is difficult to decide. Rule 25 of the parole board rules needs to be reformulated. It is entirely the rules imposed on the parole board by the government about secrecy. A hugely difficult question whether, if the world becomes like I want it to be, with much more judicial scrutiny of sentencing, whether that is all public scrutiny of sentencing. And I think probably it should be. I can't see why parole board hearings should be more secret than Crown Court hearings. It's a sadness to me how empty courts are, that Cambridge University law students will say to me, oh, are we allowed to visit courts? I think it's just amazing that, you know, when I grew up, which was a very long time ago, I don't think there really was daytime television, and Crown Courts and Magistrates' Courts were full of old boys keeping warm who would tell keen 17-year-olds which courts were the interesting ones to go to. They were buzzing with a life that they just don't buzz with now. So there are lots of issues there. I think there are theoretical and practical reasons for arguing that sentences should be interested in imposing the right sentence, but thinking about how it works. And that's the, there's so much packed into that last sentence. It involves the training of judges. Judges, generally speaking, don't really like going to prison because it's not a very nice thing to do. They certainly don't think, if they've got a 2.5-day training course, that they want to read Tony Bottoms' latest paper on desistance from crime. But I think they should want to read Tony Bottoms' latest paper on desistance from crime. French judges genuinely do. They are very interested, or the ones I've met, I haven't met all of them, but they are much more interested, generally speaking, in these issues. And I think it's in part because they're different creatures, but it's in part because they're doing this implementation of sentencing. They are sitting in their offices, seeing these people who are breaching their community orders day in, day out, in their offices in a very informal way. So that's where I am. I'm on my time. I'm stopping. Poor Andrew, what a ramble to have to respond to.
Not at all. I think you've done more than any of the other people writing at the moment to make this point that the what the French call the execution of penalties, the actual carrying out of penalties, is crucial, because this actually determines the impact of the sentence on the person being sentenced. And you've talked about MAPO. There are various things to do with community sentences which one could add, but the main thing is imprisonment, as you say, and the decisions that follow on from the court's decision, you shall serve however many months or years imprisonment. From that, starting with the administrative decisions on allocation of prisoners, which are really quite crucial in the lives of the prisoners themselves, and then all the stuff on release, on recall, which you, above all, I think, have pointed out time and time again in writings. Now, of course, you say that lawyers should be more aware of what's going on at this stage in the sentencing process, because you start with the question, what is a sentence? And your answer is, all of this is about the sentence, because it's about the ending of the sentence. You say that lawyers should know more about this, but of course one of the problems is that there isn't much judicial intervention in this, and there's nowhere for lawyers to appear. They might have a general interest in what happened, but part of your very argument is that these are not necessarily judicialized steps, and therefore there's no hearing. And a recall is the big scandal, as you know. At least there is some sort of a system now, but these lawyers are not involved practically in these stages, and that's why when one discusses sentencing, these factors don't really surface often enough. However, just to repeat, I wholly agree with your general argument that the what is a sentence should be answered by looking at the duration of the sentence and the decisions taken in respect of that duration. That, I think, is quite crucial. Now, what I wanted to add to this a little bit is to return to your very first words, which is, what is a sentence? And to your point under breadth that a sentence equals a criminal sanction equals a disposal. And then above you say sentencing is a judicial function. Now, I accept all that, but I'm interested in what you have at the top of your second page, where, and you referred to this in your talk, where you're talking about conditional cautions, PNDs, so on and so on, are not really criminal sanctions, but they feel like them. And then you mention EU criminal law, about which I shall not speak, because I would certainly not end speaking if I started on European criminal law. So I shall get back to where I wanted, and that is a definition of a sentence. What is a sentence? Now, from my point of view, I would have looked more for a substantive definition, something like the imposition of hard treatment in order officially to censure a person for wrongdoing. I think wrongdoings needs to be in there so we don't get taxation in there, because taxation, of course, is hard treatment. But a sentence is the imposition of hard treatment in order officially to censure a person for wrongdoing. Now, I haven't worked on that definition, but it's a sort of loose definition. And what I would like to bring it to bear on is those points made at the top of your second page. So what about a PND, a penalty notice for disorder? Is that a sentence? Or a simple caution? Or reprimand or final warning given by the police, or a conditional caution given by the CPS, as you say. Are they sentences? Well, to turn to the word that you don't like, they dispose of the case. they're said to be, sometimes said by criminologists, to be methods of diverting the case from the formal criminal process. But the fact is that the people who take those decisions are sentences. They are sentencing, in a manner of speaking. Now, of course, you can say it's always a person's right, if they are handed a PND by a police officer or whatever, to say, no, I don't know, like, if you want to get me, you have to take me to court. They can say that, and that's what satisfies Article 6 of the European Convention. But we all know in practice hardly anybody says that, and hardly anybody has the nerve or self-confidence to say that in the presence of a police officer. So it's very rare for them to be challenged. And of course, even if you do challenge them, you probably get some grumpy magistrate said, you were offered an £80 fine for this, I'm fining you £200. Thank you. So the point is there that I think that's a sort of sentence. I think PNDs, and I think we've got to, or at least we have to look at the definition of a sentence in the light of that sort of thing. It's not a judicial matter at the moment. It can be, but it's not a judicial matter. It's a way of police officers, other functionaries who don't normally have a sentencing function, dealing with the case, disposing of the case. And then the other thing, which again you mentioned at the top of page 2, and which is the proverbial can of worms, is the regulatory agencies, HMRC, the Revenue and Customs, or the Environment Agency, and all the other agencies. These have enormous powers to impose, are we going to say penalties, not sentences, or are we going to say sentences? I mean, we need a definition, and we need to be looking at carefully at this. Now, the interesting thing about those agencies is they have these powers to impose financial penalties on people, they have these plenty of powers to warn and all that sort of stuff. But they are part of a strategy, which is a very different strategy to the one pursued by the police and the CPS. They're part of a compliance strategy, normally, where they use, they reserve the criminal process, prosecution, for a very small, defined group of cases, very serious cases, last resort, very persistent offenders, and that sort of thing. They generally do not resort to the courts and to prosecution. So, again, there is not just a question there about whether those measures fulfil a definition of a sentence, which I've given them a possible definition of, not just that, but also, are there policies, the right policies? Are they justifiable policies? Who says? Who stands over the regulatory agencies to say whether they are taking the right approach in matters of prosecutions? There's a chief inspector of prosecutions, a chief inspector of police. Is there a chief inspector of regulations? I haven't heard of one. So, not to go on for too long, but my argument is that in these other sort of quasi-sentencing cases that I've been pointing out, there are issues of, I think, of the rule of law. I think rule of law values are being neglected in these areas. I think we're just allowing things to go on without really the same values as we promote in sentencing. Look at the values that actuate the Sentencing Council. Consistency. Fairness, proportionality. Where do those appear? When we're talking about diversion, when we're talking about PNDs, when we're talking about simple cautions, conditional cautions, or any of the warnings or penalties that the regulatory agencies have the power to give. It seems to me we call for sentencing guidance or sentencing guidelines, you know, we've got this big fat volume on sexual offences, but we have nothing on these other types of decision about imposing detrimental consequences on people for wrongdoing. So the CPS has its code, okay, but that's not really aligned with the prosecution policy of the regulatory agencies, and not the police don't particularly have a binding set of obligations for PNDs and that sort of thing. So I won't go on, and just want to add to what you said, without disagreeing with what you said at all, because I do think that's very important, add this other argument, which does surface in your paper, about other forms of sentencing, other forms of disposal, and see if anyone wants to take up those points, as well as the points that Nikki has been hammering home for years, and don't seem to have
not
really
very successful.
Well, no, but that's because there's resistance, that's why.
Thank you.
Thank you.